Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, November 21st, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we're live to tape today because of the, 36 hours of radio that we did over the course of 24 hours over the past day. What we have for you today is a compilation on where we are in impeachment and also a recap of last night's Democratic debate. Throw that together. Everybody's resting up from that. So that is what we will present to you today on the program. And we should say we can bring that down now. Obviously, there's some other news going on, but these are the two big stories right now as it, is the 2020 election. What took place at the debate last night? We will get to that. In fact, truth be told, we're recording this yesterday afternoon, so the debate hasn't happened. But by the time you hear the debate recap, that is later in this program, it will have happened. My predictions, if you want me to make some, people are going to go after Pete Buttigieg from both the left and from the center. And the guy's a little sticky. I mean, he's a little dodging weavy. But we will see, and we will see, I don't know, in about 20-25 minutes from now as you listen to this. But what we are going to do is I'm going to catch you up on what's happened with sort of the highlights of impeachment. Look, I think this is a big deal. I think it's silly that I actually have to say I think it's a big deal, but from a history standpoint, there's only three times in the history of this country that we've gotten this far in terms of impeachment. Once was with Andrew Johnson. Once was with Bill Clinton, and now here we are in terms of Donald Trump. Now, it's apples and orange a little bit with Nixon, because Nixon, they voted to sort of start the impeachment hearings, and they had already sort of had investigations in the Senate. I'm not 100% sure on the history of that, but nevertheless, three, four times in the history of the country, whatever. It is historically relevant. And I should say, I think the ethical and civic case for holding your leaders accountable, I think, is there. The fact that we rarely do this is no defense as to why we shouldn't do it more. And I think Donald Trump is corrupt, and I think in some respects uniquely corrupt, maybe not necessarily quantitatively, but qualitatively. Or vice versa. I don't know how you want to put this. I mean, I think there's a good argument that every single United States president we have in some way could be tried for something and should be. But you go with the opportunities that you have. That is from a civic and ethical standpoint. From a political standpoint, I've said this 100 times, so I'm going to say it 101 times. There is nothing a Democratic president is going to be able to do with a Republican Senate. I don't know if they'll have an opportunity to seat a Supreme Court justice. They certainly won't be able to really impact the federal judiciary even close to the way that Donald Trump has. They also will not be able to pass any of its legislation. Now, even a Democratic Senate is going to have big challenges for a Democrat who wants to push progressive policies. the Joe Mansons, the Kristen Sinemas, the people, Hickenlooper, if we end up getting him. Is it Hickenlooper in Colorado? Wait, what's that guy's name? Is it Hickenlooper? Jeez, that just sounds so ridiculous. But Hickenlooper, these are all going to be problems. They're going to be more easily surmountable than a Senate that is run by Mitch McConnell. So if your thing, and there's a lot of folks in our audience who for it is the totally their thing and some partially, that politics are only relevant insofar as you can make a direct line as to material benefits for people. And I think, you know, that's a fair perspective to take. What's happening in terms of impeachment and in terms of its implications for control of the Senate are huge. And in some ways, I think it has shaped the tenor of the impeachment hearings because, and I think, and I would say not just for the Senate, but also for the frontline Democrats. There is talk right now that Nancy Pelosi is feeling pressure from the frontline Democrats. And that is people who are in purple districts. Remember now, there's only three districts in the entire country. Is it three or four? Where a district that Hillary Clinton won in the presidential election is represented by a Republican. There's only three out of the, what, 100, 438? What is five? How many? Whatever. However, how much? 538 in the... In the House, only three. Now, you could argue that Hillary Clinton should have won more districts. Maybe the next presidential, Democratic presidential candidate will. But it's the point is the margins aren't that huge there. For better or for worse, the Democrats have it in mind that these districts have a lot of I would imagine a lot of sort of. You know, old style Republicans who care about national security, care about their tax being cut and, get scared at the words, Medicare or whatever it is. And so to a certain extent, the impeachment hearings, I think, have been geared towards that a little bit. Maybe we'll talk a little bit later about whether they should be so narrowly tailored to just Ukraine. That's another topic. But there is, there has been throughout this a quality of trying to make people understand that the national security implications of Ukraine. And that's all well and good. From my perspective, the real issue here is even if this was, Great Britain, the idea that the president would leverage official acts. Taxpayer money to enrich himself, in this instance, with valuable services in kind in his to wage his 2020 election, I think is highly problematic. With all that said, between Maria Yovanovitch, who was the ambassador to Ukraine, I was frankly impressed by just this is a woman who has been working in the U.S. Foreign Service for years, did a great job, took her job very seriously, was taken out because she was an obstacle to Rudy Giuliani's so-called drug deal. That's the way that John Bolton characterized his sort of secret missions on behalf of the president. And they also brought in this guy, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. They had him wear his uniform. He has a purple medal. He has an infantry... medallion, I guess, served in Iraq. He came here as a young boy from Russia. I think his mom passed away at an early age. Apparently, he was the subject with his twin brother of a Ken Burns documentary when they were here as immigrants. And he came to speak, and his testimony was very compelling. It basically... I'll get into the details in a moment, but let's just start off with this, which was like a spontaneous applause. And look, it's sappy. And I usually don't go for this, but I think it was, somebody had tweeted at me like impeachment's political theater. And I'm like, I do this every day from literally a set. So yes, guess what? Politics is theater. That is part of this. And yes, this impeachment is theatrical because it is a political process. It is not a criminal one. And it is there is an attempt where we are trying to convince the American public that the Republican Party is protecting a very corrupt guy. I think the substance is important, but to ignore the theater is, I'm sorry, like, it is real. And here is Vindman. I don't think he was performing. I mean, I think we can assess his performance, but I don't think that's what it was about for him. He and his family, including his father and extended family, are having to be protected on army bases because of the threats coming from the Trump followers. Here is Vindman. At one point, he's being questioned by Sean Maloney, not my favorite congressman. He's from New York. Vindman just, this is, you know, this is the type of stuff that the American public should be eating up on some level.
You realize when you came forward out of sense of duty that you were putting yourself in direct opposition to the most powerful person in the world. Do you realize that, sir?
I knew I was assuming a lot of risk.
And I'm struck by that word, that phrase, do not worry, you addressed to your dad. Was your dad a warrior?
He did serve. It was a different military, though.
And he would have worried if you were putting yourself up against the President of the United States, is that right?
He deeply worried about it, because in his context, there was the ultimate risk.
And why do you have confidence that you can do that and tell your dad not to worry?
Congressman, because this is America. This is the country I've served and defended, that all of my brothers have served, and here, right matters.
Thank you, sir. Yield back.
Oh, well, you eliminated the applause, which was the big, that's all right.
Yield back.
All right, so they break out in applause. A little bit sappy, but if you know anybody who's come from, a country like that, there is at least, you know, from an aspirational standpoint on one level or another, there's a real sense that, you know, America is unique. And I don't have to subscribe to that, and I can find it a little bit sappy and understand that it's pretty effective. Now, the big aspects of Vindman's testimony were that he went on multiple occasions to the Inspector General of the NSC to basically report something he saw was inappropriate. The first time was July 10th, and he's in a meeting with Bolton, other American representatives, including Sundland. Volcker may or may not have been there. And three representatives from the Ukrainian government, where Sundland brought up the investigation into the Bidens. This is according to Vindman. John Bolton ended the meeting abruptly. They had photographs that they took to leverage, to allow the Ukrainians to leverage their visit with the United States. Then they went downstairs to another meeting where Bolton basically said, we're not getting involved in this Rudy Giuliani. And he's presumably saying it to Sundland. We're not getting involved in this Rudy Giuliani drug deal. And apparently Bolton basically told everybody, go talk to lawyers. Go tell the lawyers. Well, I want this on record. Create some type of contemporaneous report. Vindman goes to the IG. The IG says, if anything like this comes up again, come tell me. And the moment the phone conversation on July 25th is over with Donald Trump and the Ukrainian President Zelensky, where the Bidens are mentioned, where Burisma is mentioned, where 2016 election is mentioned, Vindman goes down the hall, essentially, and reports it again. And that's basically it. And the thing is, so what Vindman did was the first time that the whole hearsay thing, that goes out the window. That goes completely out the window. The other highlights of that, they wanted Vindman to basically out the whistleblower. Vinland said he does not know who the whistleblower is. I believe that's the case. But he does know who he spoke to. And if and I think the Republicans know that the whistleblower spoke to Vinland. Now, Vinland may have talked to like a half a dozen people. He doesn't know which one of them is the whistleblower. So they want him to tell who he spoke to, and he won't do it. In a minute, we'll play that clip of Vinland responding about the assessment that Morrison made about him, that he was unsound in terms of judgment. And he whips out the file. Do you have that one? See if you can find that for me. In the meantime, I should tell you that one of today's sponsors is News Voice. It's the first ever entirely open, crowdsourced, and democratized platform for news. You can download the app for free at newsvoice.com/majority. Look, we live in a country where a huge percentage, I don't know, the vast majority of news owned by the same five corporations. We need to pay attention to where our news comes from, who owns which media outlets, which political biases may be in play, which political and frankly, financial biases may be in play. That's exactly what News Voice helps you keep track of. It's a free crowdsourced website and mobile app, lets you create a personal news feed and maintain a clear picture of where your news is coming from, what political slants, financial agendas may exist. It helps you aggregate news from corporate outlets, from international outlets, from local news outlets, from independent media like this one. It gives you access to every side of every story. News Voice is fueled by its community of users who contribute to the platform by fact-checking, submitting stories, sources that are missing, upvoting stories, and writing story summaries. You can comment on stories. You can debate politics with other members if you want in the community. You can stay active in the community. You can level up and earn perks on the platform. The News Voice Play feature lets you listen to your personal news feed every day. And you can customize that audio news playlist. It's your own personally tailored radio station for news. News Voice is a next generation news aggregator and social media platform that values transparency, good journalism, and productive political discussions. You can get totally free access by going to newsvoice.com/majority. We have a link in the video if you're watching on video. We have a link in the podcast if you're watching by podcast. Check it out, newsvoice.com/majority. And also, I have a question for you. Would you rather be busy or would you rather be productive? Some folks around here, they look like they're doing busy work. They pretend like they're doing work. They're not really. They're not being productive. Other people, they're quietly productive. Well, now you can start making your work take less work and find the right software for you at Capterra.com/majority. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. Look, they have over a million reviews of products from real software users, and you can discover everything you need to make an informed decision. There are more than 700 specific categories of software, everything from project management to email marketing, yoga studio management software. No matter what kind of software you need for your business, Capterra makes it easy to discover the right solution fast. You can join millions of people who use Capterra each month to find the right tools for their business. Look, sometimes people don't realize this. Like, you have a small business, you have a large business, you don't realize, but there is software for this business. I mean, I scroll through this thing, and people know this. I've mentioned this before. I scroll through just, you know, when I'm feeling like, what if I had the ability to go out and do something different, what would I do? Because I didn't, you know, I only knew like basically there were three ways of making money. You could be a lawyer, you could sell cars, because my uncle did, and then you could be an actor, comedian, and now it's a podcaster. But there are apparently other ways to make money. And I go through Capterra. I see like, oh, there's review management software. I don't know what that means. Robotic process automation software. Sales coaching software. I'm just going down the S's. School accounting software. Self-storage software. SEO software. Actually, we could probably use that. Shopping cart software. You want to set up an online business, small business CRM software. Somebody knows what CRM means, content, something, R management, small business e-commerce software, spa software, speech therapy software, sports league software, anything that you can imagine that possibly exists for your business, and stuff that you can't is there. And then you click on those one of those 700 categories, you get examples of every possible software that's there with reviews. Nothing could be better. And, well, it could be better. It's free. Visit Capterra.com/majority for free. And do it today to find the tools to make an informed decision for your business. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's Capterra.com/majority for your software decision. Capterra software selection simplified. All right. So getting back to the review of impeachment, let's go one more time with Vindman. They tried to get rid of Vindman. They tried to undercut his testimony, which basically said, like, I heard the Bidens came up multiple times. I went and how are they going to undercut this guy who shows up with a Purple Heart on his chest in a uniform? Basically the classic American story, right? He came over here as immigrants, and his two brothers are also in the service, and one of them is actually the NSC. Well, you got to make the guy seem like he's crazy, like he's unbalanced. And apparently Tim Morrison, who came into his job late, Morrison's a very strange character. We'll talk about him soon. He replaced Fiona Hill at the NSC, but then he resigned like 3 or 4 months later. Supposedly that was always the plan, which is a weird thing to do in and of itself. But here's Jim Jordan trying to raise, like, there's some questions about your judgment, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. And Vindman basically, you know, exposes, no pun intended when we talk about Jim Jordan,
So your boss had concerns about your judgment. Your former boss, Dr. Hill, had concerns about your judgment. Your colleagues had concerns about your judgment. And your colleagues felt that there were times when you leaked information. Any idea why they have those impressions, Colonel Vindman?
Yes, Representative Jordan. I guess I'll start by reading Dr. Hill's own words, as she attested to in my last evaluation that was dated middle of July, right before she left. Alex is a top 1% military officer and the best Army officer I've worked with in my 15 years of government service. He is brilliant, unflappable, and exercises excellent judgment.
He was exemplary
during numerous visits, so forth and so on, but I think you get the idea. Mr. Morrison, yeah, the date of that was, July 13th. So, Mr. Jordan, I would say that I can't say what why Mr. Morrison questioned my judgment. We had only recently started working together. He wasn't there very long, and we were just trying to figure out our relationship. Maybe it was a different cultures, military culture versus.
And Colonel, you never leaked information?
I never did, never would. That is preposterous that I would do that. Okay.
Now, keep in mind, okay, the phone, the meeting where Bolton says it's a drug deal is July 10th. Fiona Hill leaves 2 days later. She hands it over to Morrison. Morrison's already resigned. We're talking 5 months. He already resigned, and he claims he was always going to do that. Morrison's a very sketchy figure, and he comes up next after Vindland. So that's Vindland's testimony there, and that was pretty devastating. And basically what the Democrats are doing, they've been rolling this stuff out. Now, in the afternoon, this is on Tuesday afternoon, Volker and Morrison are there as Republican witnesses. The Republicans got to call witnesses. Volker and Morrison were there. I would argue not the best witnesses for the Republicans. Not the best witnesses. Here's Volker. And again, I think like between Volker and Sondland, there's a major CYA going on, which is where they pretend they don't realize that Burisma means Biden. They believe they're aware that Donald Trump is supposedly very worried about corruption. He's worried about two things, 2016 and Burisma. because he's supposedly concerned about corruption. Now, Ukraine has a lot of corruption. Everybody has testified it's endemic there. And Burisma is, I think, like their biggest oil company, if not their biggest, the biggest, close. But why would Donald Trump be so obsessed about one company when you're talking about corruption? Why would you be obsessed by one company? Apparently, nobody ever asked that question of themselves. Because if they did, they would go, huh, Burisma, I'm going to put that into Google like Tim Morrison did. And you find, oh, number two, Hunter Biden. So it stretches the imagination, but the Democrats didn't seem to care, because what they want from Volcker is that now they look back and realize that Burisma equals Biden, because we don't really have to prove that they knew it. All you need to do is prove that the president was thinking that. And he already told us on July 25th on that phone call, that's what it was to him.
Understand that others believe that any investigation of Ukrainian company Burisma, which had a history of accusations of corruption, was tantamount to investigating Vice President Biden. I drew a sharp distinction between the two. It has long been U.S. policy under multiple administrations to urge Ukraine to investigate and fight internal corruption. I was quite comfortable with Ukraine making its own statement about its own policy of investigating and fighting corruption at home. At the one in-person meeting I had with Mayor Giuliani on July 19th, Mayor Giuliani raised, and I rejected, the conspiracy theory that Vice President Biden would have been influenced in his duties as vice president by money paid to his son. As I previously testified, I have known Vice President Biden for 24 years. He is an honorable man, and I hold him in the highest regard. At no time was I aware of or knowingly took part in an effort to urge Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Biden. And as you know, from the extensive documentation I provided, Vice President Biden was not a topic of discussion. I was not on the July 25th phone call between President Trump and President Zelensky, and I was not made aware of any reference to Vice President Biden or his son by President Trump until the transcript of that call was released on September 25th, 2019. Throughout this time, I understood that there was an important distinction between Burisma and Biden, and I urged the Ukrainians to maintain such a distinction. I did not know that President Trump or others had raised Vice President Biden with Ukrainians, or had conflated the investigation of possible Ukrainian corruption with investigation of the former vice president. In retrospect, for the Ukrainians, it would clearly have been confusing. In hindsight, I now understand that others saw the idea of investigating possible corruption involving the Ukrainian company Burisma as equivalent to investigating former Vice President Biden. I saw them as very different, the former being appropriate and unremarkable, the latter being unacceptable. In retrospect, I should have seen that connection differently, and had I done so, I would have raised my own objections.
I don't buy it. Again, not that important, but I mean, he's a pretty smart guy. Why would Donald Trump and the others, as he said, why would they be so interested in Burisma? Why would Donald Trump care about Burisma as opposed to any of the other companies or just the endemic corruption that exists in the entire country? I guess it never stopped to ask that question. But had he understood that, he would have complained. So in other words, he establishes two things there. One, that there were others who clearly believed that Burisma was code for Biden's. And two, that it was highly problematic. That's the Republican witness.
Oops.
Oops is right. And then later, Volcker being questioned by Adam Schiff. In his opening, like I say, Volcker has already established that others were conflating Burisma and Biden, and that had he known, he would have complained because it would have been wholly inappropriate. He just didn't know. Okay. This is, again, the Republican witness, or one of the witnesses the Republicans called. And here he is basically saying, oh, yeah. And incidentally, this whole story about the Ukrainians never finding out that Burisma meant Biden's and that that aid was withheld for that. Yeah, I'm about to sink that talking point, too.
In fact, he was contacted by someone within the Ukrainian embassy who was concerned about the whole prior to its becoming public.
I was not aware of that, but I take that.
Are you aware of Ms. Croft's testimony and transcripts that have been released that, in fact, the Ukrainians found out quite quickly after the hold was placed in July that she was impressed with Ukrainian tradecraft and that the Ukrainians had a reason to keep it silent, not make it public?
I saw that in her testimony.
Pause it. Just to be clear what that means, that the Ukrainians knew that it was being withheld. They just knew it was smart not to acknowledge that publicly. Tradecraft. Because if they make it an issue, then they're sort of like people are going to take corners and sides. And they didn't want that because they need that money.
Keep it silent, not make it public.
I saw that in her testimony.
You don't have any reason to question whether, in fact, that testimony was accurate, do you?
No, I don't.
So the Ukrainians did find out before it was public, at least according to these two witnesses. But nevertheless, the Ukrainians certainly found out it was public when it was published in the newspaper, right?
That is correct, in August 29th.
And at the time they found out from the newspaper, they still hadn't had the White House meeting, and they still didn't have the aide. And at that point, they had already had the conversation with the president in which he asked them to investigate the Bidens, correct?
That is correct.
There you go. That doesn't help the Republicans too much. That eliminates more time. I mean, that's basically what we've seen all week. It's just, you know, sort of like narrowing of the talking points that Devin Nunes can bring up at the beginning of every hearing. And by the end of the week, he's talking like he's almost on Vince Foster. He's almost has to go to Vince Foster, but it is all dossier and it's all a Russian talk. But continuing on with the testimony on Tuesday, here is Tim Morrison being questioned by the Democratic House counsel, Daniel Goldman. And the strange thing about Morrison, in addition to having already established that his critique of Vindman was sort of contrary to the assessments that Vindman had gotten from Fiona Hill, Tim Morrison, former National Security Council for Russia director, replaces Fiona Hill and then resigns within months, which he says he had always contemplated even before all this came out. But all right, that seems like a very weird way to run your business. Take the job and then immediately resign. And Morrison is being asked. Well, first off, Morrison goes to the lawyers, the internal lawyers, multiple times. And when he's asked why, he just says, well, I just wanted to let them know the call happened. And they're like, why? Well, just because there was nobody there who knew that the call happened. Well, why would you feel it necessary for you to go and tell them that the call happened? No reason. No reason. I didn't think it was wrong. I just wanted to make them know that that it happened. And now he's also claiming that the reason why the call was put into the classified server, turns out he was told it was just an administrative error. Here we go.
Now, Mr. Morrison, shortly after you heard the July 25th call, you testified that you alerted the NSC legal advisor, John Eisenberg, pretty much right away. Is that right?
Correct.
And you indicated in your opening statement, or at least from your deposition, that you went to Mr. Eisenberg out of concern over the potential political fallout if the call record became public and not because you thought it was illegal. Is that right?
Correct.
But you would agree, right, that asking a foreign government to investigate a domestic political rival is inappropriate, would you not?
It's not what we recommended the president discuss.
Now, in a second meeting with Mr. Eisenberg, what did you recommend that he do to prevent the call record from leaking?
I recommended we restrict access to the package.
Had you ever asked the NSC legal advisor to restrict access before?
No.
Did you speak to your supervisor, Dr. Kupperman, before you went to speak to John Eisenberg?
No.
Did you subsequently learn that the call record had been put in a highly classified system?
I did.
And what reason did Mr. Eisenberg give you for why the call record was put in the highly classified system?
It was a mistake.
He said it was just a mistake?
It was an administrative error.
Now, isn't it also true, though, that you had authority to restrict access on the regular system if you wanted to?
I believe I could have instructed the appropriate staff to do so, yes.
So why did you go to the NSE legal advisor to recommend that?
Well, I was also concerned that based on the participants in the listening room that day, I did not then, and I do not now, recall any representatives from the NSE legal advisor's office, as they were often on head of state calls, but not always. And I wanted to make sure that John Eisenberg, as the legal advisor, and his deputy were aware to review this particular transcript.
And you wanted them to review it because you were concerned about the potential political consequences, not because of it was anything was wrong?
Correct. And political consequences was an umbrella term I used in my statement to describe a series of effects I feared about what would happen if and when the content of the transcript or the content of the MemCon leaked.
So just to make sure I understand this correctly, Mr. Morrison, you heard the call. You recognize that President Trump was not discussing the talking points that the NSC had prepared based on official U.S. policy and was instead talking about the investigations that Fiona Hill had warned you about. And then you reported it immediately to the NSC legal advisor. Is that the correct chain of events here?
That's correct.
All right. So to be clear, the guy takes the job about 6 days before this call from Fiona Hill, maybe 7 days. She says, hey, one thing to look out for is that there's some weird stuff that's going on. We just had a meeting where John Bolton said, we're not getting involved in this Rudy Giuliani drug deal. There's some weird stuff that's going on in terms of the president leveraging U.S. taxpayer assistance and trading meeting with Ukrainian president for help in his campaign. So just a heads up on that. And 5 days later, he's on a phone call where he hears exactly that thing. And he claims, I just went to the lawyers because I thought they should review this particular transcript. Why? No reason. I want to make sure that they reviewed this particular transcript. You didn't think there was anything wrong with it? Well, I thought there was a chance if it leaked, it could be politically damaging. Why? Well, just, you know, politically damaging.
You know how politics are.
They didn't go further with him with this. They walked him up to the line. But look, that is bull, right? I mean, just you don't go see the compliance officer just to sort of say, like, will you please review this thing? Why? Just because. I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
No reason.
It's really stunning. And they walk him up to the line because I think the Democrats are like, we don't need to put every one of these people in jail, and that's going to make it harder. Let's just get them to give us what we need for Donald Trump. And by the end of the day on Tuesday, after they've heard from Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, after they heard from the Secretary of State designee to the Vice President, I think his name was Jennifer Williams. They heard from Kurt Volker and Tim Morrison, who were both Republican witnesses or witnesses called by the Republicans who did not help the Republicans whatsoever. Adam Schiff gave what I thought was a pretty good roundup of the day. Here it is.
Thank you, gentlemen. And I thank you both for your testimony today. I would highlight a couple things about what we've heard this afternoon. First, Ambassador Volker, your written testimony in which you say, in hindsight, I now understand that others saw the idea of investigating possible corruption involving the Ukrainian company Burisma as equivalent to investigating former Vice President Biden. I saw them as very different, the former being appropriate and unremarkable, the latter being unacceptable. In retrospect, you said, I should have seen that connection differently, and had I done so, I would have raised my own objections. Ambassador, we appreciate your willingness to amend your earlier testimony in light of what you now know. And I think you've made it very clear that knowing what you do today, that, in fact, the president sought an investigation of his political rival, Vice President Biden, that you would not have countenanced any effort to encourage the Ukrainians to engage in such conduct. I appreciate also that you were able to debunk, I hope, for the last time, the idea that Joe Biden did something wrong when he, in accordance with U.S. policy, sought to replace a corrupt prosecutor, something that not only the U.S. State Department wanted, not only the European Union wanted, and not only the IMF wanted, but was the consensus position of the United States national security infrastructure. You didn't get a lot of questions about that today, as other witnesses did, because I think you effectively said that was all nonsense. We appreciate your candor about that. Mr. Morrison, I think what is most remarkable about your testimony is the acknowledgement that immediately after the Vice President met with President Zelensky in Warsaw, you witnessed Gordon Sondland meeting with Andrei Yermak, a top advisor to President Zelensky, and then immediately thereafter, Sondland told you that he had informed the Ukrainians that if they wanted that $400 million in military aid, they were going to have to do those investigations that the president wanted. And you were later informed, and this is also significant as you've testified here today, that the Ambassador Sondland had a subsequent conversation with President Trump and informed you that it wasn't going to be enough for the Ukrainian prosecutor general to announce the investigations the president wanted. President Zelensky had to do it himself if he wanted to get that aid, let alone the meeting in the White House. Now, you've been asked to opine on the meaning of the term bribery, although you weren't asked to opine on the meaning of the terms high crimes and misdemeanors. But bribery, for those watching at home, is the conditioning of official acts in exchange for something of personal value. The official acts we're talking about here are a White House meeting that President Zelensky desperately sought, and as you have acknowledged, Ambassador Volker, was deeply important to this country at war with Russia, to show the United States had this new president's back. That meeting was important. That meeting is an official act. The military assistance is even more significant because Ukrainians are dying every day in their war with Russia. And so the withholding of military assistance to get these investigations, which you now have acknowledged, Ambassador Volker, was wrong for the president to request, the idea of withholding that military aid to get these political investigations should be anathema, to repugnant to every American, because it means the sacrifice, not just of Ukrainian national security, but American national security, for the interests of the president personally and politically. Now, my Republican colleagues, all they seem to be upset about with this is not that the president sought an investigation of his political rival, not that he withheld a White House meeting and $400 million in aid we all passed on a bipartisan basis to pressure Ukraine to do those investigations. Their objection is he got caught. Their objection is that someone blew the whistle, and they would like this whistleblower identified, and the president wants this whistleblower punished. That's their objection, not that the president engaged in this conduct, but that he got caught. Their defense is, well, he ended up releasing the aid. Yes, after he got caught. That doesn't make this any less odious. Now, Americans may be watching this and asking, why should the United States care about Ukraine? Why should we care about Ukraine? And this was the import, I think, of the conversation, the now infamous conversation, in that Kiev restaurant with Gordon Sondland holding the phone away from his head because the president was talking so loud. What does the president ask in that call the day after the now infamous call he had with Zelensky? What does he ask on that cell phone call? Not whether the Rada had passed some new anti-corruption reform. No. Are the Ukrainians going to do the investigation? Meaning into Biden. And Sondland's answer is, they're going to do it. They'll do essentially anything the president wants. But what's more telling is the conversation, I think, that Sondland has with the Foreign Service Officer Holmes afterwards, in which the president says, basically, Donald Trump doesn't give a expletive about Ukraine.
He cares about the big things. And Mr. Holmes says, well, Ukraine's at war with the Russians. That's kind of a big thing. And Sondland's answer is no. He cares about big things that affect his personal interests. This is why Americans should care about this. Americans should care about what happens to our allies who are dying. But Americans should care about their own national security and their own president and their own constitution. And they will need to ask themselves, as we will have to ask ourselves in Congress, are we prepared to accept that a president of the United States can leverage official acts, military assistance, White House meetings, to get an investigation of a political rival? Are we prepared to say, well, you know, I guess that's just what we should expect of a president of the United States? I don't think.
Okay. I mean, you get the gist of it. I mean, I thought that was pretty good. I would have also thrown in the idea of, like, he is looking for election interference. You know, there's one other element of it. It's not just, I'm going to make $60 million or I'm going to get a new hotel or whatever it is. It's election interference. And then the other thing that occurs to me, frankly, is there's an opportunity if you start to pursue other things to start saying this is a pattern of behavior by Donald Trump, where he is leveraging U.S. policy, the future of this country, and often, you know, leading to, like, more arms sales to Yemen. I mean, to Saudi Arabia for the Yemen war, for instance. For personal gain. Now, I don't know that that's the case, but does anybody really think that Donald Trump only has this perspective with Ukraine? The whole point, if you widen out this impeachment hearing, you're going to start to find a pattern of this type of behavior. Where's the IRS whistleblower? Why has that guy been buried? So that's the only thing I would say, is that that's the argument to widen this out. That takes us to Wednesday, where Gordon Sondland shows up, and it was pretty amazing because Devin Nunes is doing his introduction. The way it works, Schiff gives his introduction. Devin Nunes gives his introduction. Then you allow the opening statement of Sondland. The moment Nunes starts speaking for his introduction of the proceedings, an abbreviated testimony of Sondland's opening remarks is published, and you can see it online. And it becomes clear, very quick reading of it, that he explicitly says there's a quid pro quo. And he also says everybody was in the loop. And by everybody, he means Bolton. He means Pompeo. He means everybody. Everybody. And Nunes, while I was reading this and a lot of other people were reading this, Nunes is going, like, they have you here to smear you and blah, blah, blah. He doesn't realize that Sondland has basically said, like, I'm giving them all they want, except for I'm going to maintain this fiction that I didn't realize that Burisma equals Biden. And so Nunes got blindsided. I mean, you can go check Twitter at that moment. I think it was like a million people who tweeted the exact same thing. Like, did Devin Nunes not read the opening statement? And he didn't. He must not have. But here is Sondland. This is a segment of it where he says there was a quid pro quo and everybody was in the loop.
Summarize 10 hours of previous deposition testimony. However, a few critical points have been obscured by noise over the last few days and weeks. And I'm worried that the bigger picture is being ignored. So let me make a few key points. First, Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and I worked with Mr. Rudy Giuliani on Ukraine matters at the express direction of the President of the United States. We did not want to work with Mr. Giuliani. Simply put, we were playing the hand we were dealt. We all understood that if we refused to work with Mr. Giuliani, we would lose a very important opportunity to cement relations between the United States and Ukraine. So we followed the president's orders. Second, Although we disagreed with the need to involve Mr. Giuliani, at the time we did not believe that his role was improper. As I previously testified, if I had known of all of Mr. Giuliani's dealings or his associations with individuals, some of whom are now under criminal indictment, I personally would not have acquiesced to his participation. Still, given what we knew at the time, what we were asked to do did not appear to be wrong. Third, let me say, precisely because we did not think that we were engaging in improper behavior, we made every effort to ensure that the relevant decision makers at the National Security Council and the State Department knew the important details of our efforts. The suggestion that we were engaged in some irregular or rogue diplomacy is absolutely false. I have now identified certain State Department emails and messages that provide contemporaneous support for my view. These emails show that the leadership of the State Department, the National Security Council, and the White House were all informed about the Ukraine efforts from May 23, 2019, until the security aid was released on September 11, 2019. I will quote from some of those messages with you shortly. Fourth, as I testified previously, Mr. Giuliani's requests were a quid pro quo for arranging a White House visit for President Zelensky. Mr. Giuliani demanded that Ukraine make a public statement announcing the investigations of the 2016 election DNC server and Burisma. Mr. Giuliani was expressing the desires of the President of the United States, and we knew these investigations were important to the President.
Okay, I think that's basically the two things that you needed to know there. One is Sondland fingers just about everybody involved in the administration, and two says it was Giuliani was the irregular channel. We were all being played for suckers, and I didn't realize that when he was going around saying Burisma, he was talking about Biden. That's what Sondland says. And here is Schiff asking Sondland, like, how is it possible you didn't know Burisma equals Biden? And according to Sondland, even though we have Vinland saying that it happened in a conversation on July 10th, and even though we have Bolton freaking out on July 10th, ending the meeting early, and then reconvening downstairs and saying you can't get involved in Rudy Giuliani's drug deal, Sondland maintains that he doesn't know what it is. And all right, well, let's not this one. This is I'm talking about number 10. Number 10. And at different points, Sondland makes it clear that Pence and that Pompeo are involved in this, but he establishes that up in his pre-testimony. But here is Schiff questioning Sondland about the Burisma Biden connection. Again, not crucial because somebody else has made that connection for us publicly, and his name is Donald Trump. But here is Schiff.
I have a few questions before I turn it back to Mr. Goldman. You testified in response to my colleagues in the minority, something along the lines of, a lot of people did not make the connection between Burisma and Biden. I think a lot of people have real difficulty understanding that. Tim Morrison testified that I think it took him all of doing a Google search to find out, oh, this is the significance of Burisma. It involves the Bidens. Are you saying during all this time up until the call, you never made the connection between Burisma and the Bidens? You just thought that the president and Rudy Giuliani were interested in this one particular Ukrainian company?
Again, my role, Mr. Chairman, was just to get the meeting.
Well, I understand that, but my question is, are you saying that for months and months, notwithstanding everything Rudy Giuliani was saying on TV and all the discussion with Rudy Giuliani, that you never put Burisma together with the Bidens?
I didn't, and I wasn't paying attention to what Mr. Giuliani was saying on TV. We were talking to him directly.
Let me ask you this. Wow. Ambassador Volker testified yesterday to a similar epiphany, for lack of a better word. This is what he said. In hindsight, I now understand that others saw the idea of investigating possible corruption involving the Ukrainian company Burisma as equivalent to investigating former Vice President Biden. I saw them very different, the former being appropriate and unremarkable, the latter being unacceptable. In retrospect, I should have seen that connection differently, and had I done so, I would have raised my own objections. Does that sum up your views as well?
It does.
Oops. Oops-a-daisy. Now, how can we know, though, that there's this connection? Well, it's easy, because Donald Trump said it in the transcript that he released of his own phone call that was perfect. And he released that, I think, before he thought that everybody else would cave like they did. All right. Let's just play the reaction shots. Okay. And then we'll do Maloney's thing. But after Sondland gives his testimony, and they take a break between Sondland's, the opening remarks from Schiff, opening remarks from Nunes. Remember, these are opening remarks that Nunes clearly had not seen what Sondland was going to say, where he wouldn't have framed everything he did. Like, where he was like, I'm very sympathetic to you. You're going to get smeared here, and I'm really sorry. These Democrats are really, I can't believe it. And then Sondland goes on to say, yeah, no, everything was corrupt, and I told everybody about it, and if I knew what I knew now, I would have been a real problem. After Sondland goes through and says all this stuff that you've heard about Sondland saying, like, they knew, I just didn't make the connection, but it was wrong. This is the look that Nunes has, and the lawyer, Castor, they take a break. They go to, supposedly a bathroom break. Adam Schiff very smartly takes the time to do a press conference, essentially, or gives a little speech to sum it up. Again, political theater. That's what this is. Look at the look on Devin Nunes' face and the Steve Castor, the lawyer. Steve Castor just goes like, what am I supposed to do with that? And throws his hands up and goes back. Watch it. We'll try it one more time. This is pretty funny. Here we go. That's it. What am I supposed to do with that? You can't do anything with that. Son of a bitch. Yeah, that's... Here we go. Here's a slow-mo into Castor. Hey. What am I going to do with that? Nunes' face like, yeah, I know it. Did our best. We did our best. Here, one more angle. Everybody caught that moment. Yep, sorry guys. There it is. And later in the member questioning, Sean Maloney, he's a former prosecutor, I believe. He gets Sondland to admit essentially one element of the requirements for bribery, which is that you're getting something of personal value for doing actions that are government actions. Sondland is very hesitant, but Maloney is pretty persistent. And then the audience in the gallery, it feels like there's not a lot of Republicans in there who are interested in this, but let's listen.
You said it's wrong to investigate political opponents. We've agreed on that today, haven't we, sir?
Yes.
And yet, of course, that's what we know the president was asking for. Let me ask you something. Who would have benefited from an investigation of the president's political opponents?
I don't want to characterize who would have and who would not have.
I know you don't want to, sir. That's my question. Would you answer it for me?
Restate your question.
Who would benefit from an investigation of the president's political opponent?
Well, presumably that the person who asked for the investigation.
Who's that?
If the president asked for the investigation, it would be he.
Well, it's not a hypothetical, is it, sir? We just went around this track, didn't we? The president asked you about investigations. He was talking about the Bidens. When he asked you about the Biden investigation, who was he seeking to benefit?
He did not ask me about the Biden investigation.
When he asked you about investigations,
19 times, Mr.
Sir, Warren. Sir, we just went through this. When he asked you about investigations, which we all agree now means the Bidens, we just did this about 30 seconds ago. It's a pretty simple question, isn't it? I guess I'm having trouble why you can't just say...
When he asked about investigations, I assumed he meant...
I know what you assume.
Company.
But who would benefit from an investigation of the Bidens?
They're two different questions.
I'm just asking you one. Who would benefit from an investigation of the Bidens?
I assume President Trump would benefit.
There we have it. See? Didn't hurt a bit, did it?
I have a feeling it probably did.
Ouch.
I have a feeling it probably did hurt. Because, and the funny thing is that, you know, we heard for a long time Nunes saying, you're our star witness. And Jim Jordan said, you're the star witness. Sondland was really the star witness. And you had almost all the elements. I think all the elements, frankly, are there. That Donald Trump leveraged official acts for something that would personally benefit him. There it is. That's Johnny Ballgame. Tomorrow, we will hear from David Holmes, who will tie the whole Biden thing together. But it's really just sort of like, it's color commentary. We've already had the play-by-play. Everything has been established. All the facts are there. This is post game. This is extra credit from here on in. And I have to say that Donald Trump really had a tough time with it. After the testimony from Sondland, Donald Trump goes out on the White House lawn. He has with him a handwritten notes, and apparently there was a photograph of these notes that somebody was able to take, and you can see what it says in there. I could tell you what it says. You could look at the video, but you don't need to, because Donald Trump gets out there. He would not answer any questions, but he did have a statement, and it was pretty, if I was a member of the White House staff, I'd be a little bit concerned about how he's handling this.
Might need another unexpected visit to Walter Reed.
Exactly. He may be walking right now into like some type of like relaxation chamber. Something's got to go give with this guy. But here he is talking about Sondland, saying, here.
I'm going to go very quickly. Just
I'll pause it. I'm sorry. He is recounting Sondland's testimony about the phone call that Sondland had with him after the investigation's already started, where Trump says to Sondland, no quid pro quo. I don't want anything from the Ukrainians. I just want them to go out and do the right thing, which is to announce the investigation.
Yeah, asterisk.
Right.
But do the right thing.
Right.
Which is
exactly. Which I have said is the equivalent of me saying, I am not saying a word as I speak right now. I'm not saying anything. I am not speaking. And you can hear that. I've just said I'm not speaking. So now you know I'm not speaking. Functional equivalent. But he stopped short of the ask after that. And here is Donald Trump starring in the phone conversation he had with Sondland.
I'm going to go very quickly, just a quick comment on what's going on in terms of testimony with Ambassador Sondland. And I just noticed
he's looking
one thing,
at his
and I would say that means it's all over. What do you want from Ukraine? He asks me, screaming, what do you want from Ukraine? I keep hearing all these different ideas and theories. This is Ambassador Sondland speaking to me. just happened, to which I turned off the television. What do you want from Ukraine? I keep hearing all these different ideas and theories. What do you want? What do you want? It was a very short and abrupt conversation that he had with me. They said he was not in a good mood. I'm always in a good mood. I don't know what that is. He just said, now he's talking about what my response. So he's going, what do you want? What do you want? I hear all these theories. What do you want? Right? And now, here's my response that he gave. Just gave. Ready? You have the cameras rolling? I want nothing. That's what I want from Ukraine. That's what I said. I want nothing. I said it twice. So he goes, he asked me the question, what do you want? I keep hearing all these things. What do you want? He finally gets me. I don't know him very well. I have not spoken to him much. This is not a man I know well.
Gave him $1 million.
Seems like a nice guy, though. But I don't know him well. He was with other candidates. He actually supported other candidates. Not me. Came in late. But here's my response.
Gave $1 million
to
inauguration.
Now, if you weren't fake news, you'd cover it properly. I say to the ambassador in response, I want nothing. I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo. Tell Zelensky, President Zelensky, to do the right thing. So here's my answer. I want nothing. I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo. Tell Zelensky to do the right thing. Then he says, this is the final word from the President of the United States. I want nothing. Thank you, folks. Have a good time. I'm going to...
My God. It really does feel like he's just going to step off camera to then, I don't know, jump off a roof, right? Like, I mean, it doesn't feel like it has that quality of like on some level, I sort of wish that he had just saved that from whenever his, hopefully it's in January of 2020, but whenever his, the end of his administration will be, that is really what he needed. Like, I just want you to know, the president said, I want nothing. That is very much like his I'm not a crook, right? And bring me the... That's it. I want nothing. I never wanted anything.
Just do the right thing.
I just... Rosebud. All right, folks. That is the review of the impeachment up to today. Or I should say through Wednesday. Still some stuff missing, but these are the big stories. I mean, if you're not somebody who wants to watch the hearings, we will talk more about impeachment tomorrow, Friday on the program a little bit, particularly if there's some highlights from Fiona Hill and who else is testifying today, Thursday. I can't remember. I'm bleary-eyed myself. I want nothing. And but stick around. We are going to record a wrap of last night's debate. We'll have a couple of clips and we'll give you a sense of what our first read on the debate was. 1 second, musical interlude, maybe. And just a reminder, this show relies on you for its support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Your support makes this show possible. When you do support the program, you get it commercial free. And you get the extra bonus material that we usually do. We didn't do it today. We just gave everybody, it's just a long show. And or if you want the bonus material, go check out one of our 14 hours of worth of programming yesterday. So, and also don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Although right now, I think they have a 30% break. So you don't even need the coupon code. Try it. But you get 30% off. Go get the Majority Report blend. Try all the different blends you want at Just Coffee. It's super cool. And yeah, it's a freebie. But we're going to be doing more later. But and don't forget to sign up for the AM Quickie. All right, stick around. We will have the debate wrap coming up next. I don't know. I think let's start this recap right now by saying that we are 3 months out. What is it? February 15th or so is the Iowa caucus.
Wait, February? Oh, we're less than 3 months.
That's almost 3 months to the day.
Yeah.
And
Jesus.
Their needs, and I don't, how many more debates do we have scheduled? It can't be more than three. It's two, right? We desperately need, as Democrats, to start to call the island, as it were. And I know that this is, in some respects, anti-democratic, right? I mean, the most democratic principle would be to have everybody who is even remotely possibly still in the race. And the fact of the matter is the vast majority of voters are still not engaging. I mean, that's just the reality. But
well, they're not giving them much to work with.
Yeah, but they're not engaging, and so they don't even know that. I mean, if there was like, if you could show me data that said 68 million people watched the first debate and they decided to stop watching after that, then I would say, okay. But the reality is the vast majority of even Democratic voters are just not paying attention. All they care about is basically get us a nominee and I want to vote against Donald Trump, to the extent that, you know, I'm talking just like your mainstream Democratic voters.
Is it possible there's only one left?
It is possible.
I'm looking at New York Times schedule, December 19th in LA.
It is.
I mean, it's the same garbage every time, though. Like, maybe they watched one a long time ago, and then they're like, this is bullshit, and they never watched one again. And they wouldn't be wrong.
If that was the case, but there really is just no data to support that. I mean, there was an exchange I saw between, I think it was... Bitkofer and it's been a long day, folks. Dave from the Washington Post.
I know you're a little grumpy, so I won't lean on it now, but Sam Biden is happening.
Well, it's true.
Dave from
I have literally
Washington
been
Post
on,
Dave.
I started broadcasting this morning at 8:45.
Yeah, yeah. It's been so,
thank you very much, Tim Apple.
14 hours of streaming for Sam.
We
so
have talked about Tim Apple. Me doing a 12-hour marathon
we're
show.
Not doing that.
I've already passed it today.
This is 14.
This is hour 14 for me.
Thank you very much, Dave Washington Post. But
Dave Wapo.
The guy from
liar.
The CIA. The guy from the
CIA guys.
But
CIA
look,
Dave.
The percentages, and I don't have it right in front of me, but the percentages of people who just haven't been paying attention is just extremely high. And, you know, whether that is justifiable or not, probably, but it's not a function of them dipping in and testing the waters and finding it frustrating. It is just that they're not interested. And now, personally, from my perspective, I think the stakes are pretty high, but I'm not going to judge people. I'm just going to say this is the reality. A significant portion of people who are going to end up voting, over 50%, who are going to end up voting in the general election, have not paid one moment of attention to this primary. Not a moment of attention. And so the reality is that the choice is going to be left, it seems to me, to the people who have been engaging. And, you know, is it fair? I don't know. I mean, but the reality is that... you participate, you get a bigger say in things. I mean, that is the way that our government works.
And who do you think's base has been most motivated to participate and is most interested in their candidate?
Well, I would say Bernie, but the numbers are just sort of, it's across the board. I think, you know, Bernie has the most solid base of voters that aren't going to move.
Most people that won't change their mind.
Yeah. Basically. And I think that's just a statistic. He doesn't necessarily have the most amount of voters at this point, as far as we can tell, but these are all based upon models that may not be accurate. With all that said, I think the DNC, as anti-democratic as it is, And to some extent, this is why I'm also a proponent of having to register to vote in a party before you vote, whether it's the day of or, you know, I prefer the day of, but at least it's the moment before you vote. If you show up, you have more influence. And so I think the Democratic National Committee needs to basically raise the floor. People who getting 5% or 4%, like Amy Klobuchar or Yang or Gabbard or whomever, I don't care. If it's a candidate that I like, it doesn't matter. If you're getting 5% at this point, the bottom line is you just don't make the cut. Go off. You can go to another debate. There's nothing preventing, Castro right now from going and participating in another debate if he doesn't qualify for the DNC sanctioned debates.
I mean, I actually think it would be, if I was working for Julian Castro, I would say we're going to have a big debate night watch party and I'm going to do like a live response to it.
You get
a response. You might also have an opportunity to actually say something substantive.
Exactly. Frankly. And not have to like respond to like, well, let me tell you, I really do think it was inappropriate for certain people to chant a certain thing at my rally one time out of the 50 rallies. I mean, that's just an absurd question to
ask. And Bolivia not mentioned once. Yeah. No. Climate change. Well, no,
they can only talk
one,
about imperialism when it's China doing it.
I mean, you know, not even like, has there been a single question in any of these debates on Donald Trump pulling out of major arms control treaties? I mean, if so,
when was the last time we talked about Iran? When was the last time that we talked about, I don't know. There's a myriad of things that we've talked about that we haven't talked about. Infrastructure. We haven't talked about actual genuine immigration reform. I mean, there's been nothing since.
Credit to Bernie for. I just want to say, I think it's interesting. I saw Bernie in L.A. in East L.A. For a rally, and he is foregrounding immigration a lot. And I think it's interesting he chose to do that in his closing.
Part of the problem.
It's really important.
Part of the problem with having, now we have what, 10, 12 people on, it's still 10 people, 9 people on the stage, is that you cannot really dig in and really force the candidates, and I don't care who they are, to address things substantively. I mean, let's play. Do we have this clip of Mayor Pete on voting rights? This is a prime example of what I'm talking about. There's a question about voting rights, which is, I think, obviously a crucial question to ask. I mean, you're in Georgia, for God's sakes, where it really, there's a lot of credible people who say, and I happen to believe this, but there's a lot of credible people who say that were it not for the semi-illicit, if not illicit, voter suppression techniques, the governor, it would be a different person as governor.
Well, that's what she says. She says that's why I recognize the result.
Right. I mean, she says that, but other people say that. And here is Pete Buttigieg answering this question. And look, there are the first thing. In fact, the first thing that the Democrats did when they took the House, well, it was really the second thing. The first thing they did was basically try and demonize Ilhan Omar. The second thing they did was to pass H.R. 1, which was, frankly, a very impressive bill of a broad range of reforms, one of which included trying to provide a new calculation for Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which the Supreme Court said you can have a preclearance provision for the, I don't know, it's 18, 14 counties across the country that have a record of counties and states that have a record of suppressing the vote of minorities. But the way that you choose that preclearance now is wrong. Congress has to go and reauthorize, re-come up with something. Now, it was a horrible thing, and people can go back and listen to some of the interviews I did with Ari Berman over the years about that. But that is the first thing that needs to happen. And if you spend 10 minutes reading about restoration of voting rights in this country, that's the first thing you will say. If you spend 10 minutes on it, Pete Buttigieg has not spent 10 minutes on it. And the tip-off is he doesn't say the words Section 5. He doesn't say the words Voting Rights Act. But he does say 21st century voting rights, which I'm sorry. I don't know what the F that means.
We need federal leadership to establish voting rights for the 21st century, because this affects every other issue that we care about. Now, the House of Representatives passed a pro-democracy, anti-corruption bill, which is one of many good bills to die in Mitch McConnell's hands in the United States Senate. We know that with the White House in the right hands, we can make, for example, Election Day a federal holiday. We can use carrots and sticks to induce states to do the right thing with automatic voter registration, same-day voter registration, making it easier for people to vote, and in particular, recognizing that we cannot allow the kind of racially motivated or partisan voter suppression or gerrymandering that often dictates the outcome of election before the voting even begins. Right now, we have politicians picking out their voters rather than the other way around. That, compounding with what is being done to restrict the right to vote, means that our democracy is not worthy of the name.
These issues.
All right, and when the moderators on this debate basically interrupt you to try and get you to answer the question in something other than sort of like off the shelf pablum, you know you have a problem. And this is a guy who's just not in tune with that.
Do you think that people are, this is the question I'm really starting to have about Pete now, because I think it's all pablum. And when it isn't pablum, it's like substantively really problematic, in fact. But does his sort of total lack of preparation for such an important thing, does that come through, you think? Or do you think somebody watching it says, a 21st century voting plan? That sounds
exactly
good.
That's why I've been
so
terrified about
blaming
Mayor Pete.
The electorate.
This is chapter three of my blaming the electorate, because, everything he said there was completely there's a lot of pablum. Yes, of course, we should have good elections, and elections are important, and democracy is really a function of good elections, and 21st century.
I think those specific buzzwords, 21st century, it's a very effective pablum, because I think that's exactly the kind of false sounding intelligence that he's riding.
That's what he's always been good at.
And then the generational queuing, which is literally all he does.
There was, at the beginning of the debate, an opportunity, it seems to me, to ask a very relevant question of Joe Biden, one that I think I've repeated multiple times on this program. He has been saying for 6 to 8 months, as far as I can tell, that he has the ability to, once Donald Trump is out of the picture, that he's going to have the ability to work some type of magic with the Senate. And there's really almost like three or four different ways that you could respond to this that are all, in my opinion, devastating to Joe Biden. One is, are you effing kidding me? Donald Trump was not there during the Obama administration, and they were incredibly obstructionist. And to the extent that the Republicans got the upper hand, it was because of Joe Biden, who rushed in to do that. Go back, look at the reporting in Ryan Grimm's book, We've Got People, on how Joe Biden undercut Harry Reid on the question of the fiscal cliff. I don't want to get into that right now, but the point is, that's one tact. The other tact is to say to Joe Biden, why do you think you can do better than Barack Obama? Like, what is it that you think that you're going to do better, and why? Explain it to us.
Well, Obama was not the most skilled or charismatic politician. So
exactly. That guy was just not a natural politician.
I mean, look, he had a certain articulateness and he showered. But wait for Joe.
So I was very excited that this question was more or less asked of Joe Biden, but it was less than more, because they just let him get away with nothing and then just moved on. But here is that response. And I think it also is indicative of, like, he's having trouble talking at the beginning of this debate. I mean, let's be honest, folks.
How would you get those same Republicans to work with you?
Well, look, the next president of the United States is going to have to do two things. Defeat Donald Trump. That's number one.
Pause it. I just want to be clear. I just want to get some sequencing settled. The next president of the United States will have already beaten Donald Trump. The question is, when you become president, which presumes that you beat Donald Trump, how are you going to deal with the Senate? Okay, so the question is, what are you going to do in January of 2021, late January going forward? His entire question is everything that he's supposedly going to do before November of 2020. Maybe I'm a little stickler, but, you know, go back and let's just listen to this again.
You get those same Republicans to work with you.
Well, look, the next president of the United States can have to do two things. Defeat Donald Trump. That's number one. And number two, he's going to have to be able to go into states like Georgia and North Carolina and other places and get a Senate majority. That's what I'll do. You have to ask yourself up here, who is most likely to be able to win the nomination in the first place, to win the presidency in the first place? And secondly, who is most likely to increase the number of people who are Democrats in the House and in the Senate? And by the way, I learned something about these impeachment trials. I learned, number one, that Donald Trump doesn't want me to be the nominee. That's pretty clear. He held up aid to make sure that, while at the same time, innocent people in the Donbass are getting killed by Russian soldiers.
What?
Secondly, I found out that Vladimir Putin doesn't want me to be president. So I've learned a lot about
we
these.
We can actually negotiate that.
Yeah, but what about the Republicans?
Maybe we were
Joe.
Jumping
the
gun.
The line is, I think we have to ask ourselves the honest question: who is most likely to do what needs to be done? Produce a Democratic majority in the United States Senate, maintain the House, and beat Trump.
So let me.
He really needs to turn the key on those wind-up
choppers. That was only a minute 17, incidentally. I want you to say that, like, if you want to live forever, I would get some type of like repeated Joe Biden response on your iPhone and just play it forever, and you will live forever.
We should move to this right away.
But. Let me just, I just want to make this clear what his response was. How am I going to deal with the Republicans in the Senate once I'm president? Well, I'm going to be president. That's the first thing I'm going to do. And the second thing is, while I do that, I'm also going to make sure that there are more Democrats in the Senate. And how can I prove to you that I'm the person to do that? Because the guy whose judgment I think is completely suspect and ruining this country says that I'm the biggest threat.
Solid answer.
There you go. But lest you think that Joe Biden hasn't updated his perspective on things, he is asked a question about mm-hmm. Me Too. Now, the reason why, and this is a good question to ask Joe Biden, because Joe Biden...
It's a great one.
He is notoriously... sort of less than respectful for people's private space, personal space, particularly women's. He also left about three women, sidelined them in the Clarence Thomas hearings, and allowed Anita Hill to basically twist in the wind.
And has not apologized to her in any real way since.
Well, he sort of has.
She hasn't accepted it, though.
Right, exactly.
He's sorry that he made her feel bad.
Right.
Basically. He's sorry she got mad.
Yeah.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. And here
bless
he is.
Me, Anita.
Now, look, we are, for it is, it, but I will say this. He was asked a question about Me Too, and he stuck out, he planted the flag in I think we all have to say, is a very forward-leaning position. If this was 1935, or maybe 1895, 1875, which is, if you're a man, you should not hit a woman, unless it's in self-defense.
No man has a right to raise a hand to a woman in anger other than in self-defense, and that's rarely ever occurs. And so we have to just change the culture, period, and keep punching at it and punching at it and punching at it. It will be a big it's a gigantic issue, and we have to make it clear from the top, from the president on down, that we will not tolerate it. We will not tolerate it.
We got a culture with two black guys.
There you go. Okay.
You got to fight for self-defense, but with violence. Yes.
That was the MEB line right there. You missed that.
What did you say?
What do you tell a culture with two black eyes?
Oh, my God.
Yo, that was...
Let's just hear that one more time.
Occasionally you got one like Tulsi, and she's out there training. You might need to defend yourself.
Generally,
you don't hit a lady.
It almost never happens, but you got to punch back at people who are punching women.
I'm embarrassing
and
myself.
And also...
Oh my God, that's funny.
Now, to be fair...
I did not realize in real time how amazing that
was. To be fair...
That's hard.
To be fair, if you're listening to this, we should also tell you that Joe is burning his bra while he says this.
No man has a right to raise a hand to a woman in anger other than in self-defense, and that's rarely ever occurs. And so we have to just change...
I mean,
that's untoppable. Awesome.
Who's got the guts to stand up on stage and say that it rarely ever occurs that it's in self defense?
It's 2019. You don't hit dames anymore, eh?
Listen, just because she's got good gams, or yams, or whatever, I don't know.
And you keep punching the culture, you keep punching the misogyny, and you drag it out the door by its hair, and then you bury it in a shallow grave.
When I was vice president, I said to the patriarchy had two black eyes. I said, Joe, what did you say to it? I said, I was done talking.
Now, to be fair, let's get one decent answer in that Joe Biden had, which I think was actually...
No, this was a good answer.
It was a good answer.
Yes.
It was a good answer. And so for the sake of maintaining some faux credibility about being unbiased in this, let's play this clip of Joe Biden talking about MBS and China. I think both...
I don't know if we haven't found one of...
All right, well, forget it. He did have a good answer when it came to Saudi Arabia, and he was pretty specific about we shouldn't be supplying Saudi Arabia weapons to continue their genocide in Yemen. Okay, here it is.
Was in fact murdered and dismembered, and I believe in the order of the Crown Prince. And I would make it very clear, we were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are. There's very little social redeeming value in the present government in Saudi Arabia. And I would also, as pointed out, I would end the subsidies that we have, end the sale of material to the Saudis, who are going in and murdering children, and they're murdering innocent people. And so they have to be held accountable.
Now, here's the thing, though. Joe Biden has taken a lot of credit for what the Obama administration has done, and we can argue back and forth upon the success or failures of the Obama administration. But one thing is clear: this engagement with the Saudis in regards to Yemen, even if I give them the greatest of a benefit of doubt in terms of their intentions, and I'm not sure that I am in a position to make that assessment. But the bottom line is, it's a horrible failure. Horrible, horrible failure. Supposedly the idea was if we sort of help them out a little bit, we'll have more leverage in terms of the way that they wage this war or how deep they get into it with Yemen. And that was wrong. It was unequivocally wrong. Now, the idea that, frankly, Rachel Maddow or any of the other people on that dais, I don't want to single her out, although she has built her reputation on writing multiple books about foreign policy. The idea that the question wasn't framed in that context really did a disservice to all the viewers. It did not put any of it in context. It certainly didn't have any bearing on the way that Joe Biden is running his race. I don't know what else to say about that.
I have to say, I mean, just to really clarify, though, because I think it's particularly Ben Rhodes is trying to resuscitate himself actually through Yemen activism, which is great. I'm glad he's contributing, but his role policy-wise during the Obama administration was horrible. And most of the reporting, yes, there is a notion that maybe we can slightly restrain what the Saudis are doing, although it was already horrific atrocities, not to mention the Obama administration's own atrocities in Yemen, if you look at the drone program. But the most prevalent reporting is literally like, these guys are already really pissed and really temperamental because of the Iran deal. Why don't we just let them rain hell in Yemen, and that could sort of temper their upset? So it was really just the sort of cynical.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even if they have their best intention was that the net is going to be a positive, the bottom line is it was a failure.
No, but but the distinction is it wasn't just a question of restraining their bad impulses. It was literally saying we're not going to go to the mat on this in any way, shape, and form. We'll even support it primarily because we just don't want to have another fight with them. So yeah. They can just go and do this.
Well, I mean, I think they thought the net was that we're at least getting this Iran deal and et cetera, but it was a failure.
It
ended up in the immiseration and the ongoing, genocide, quasi genocide, whatever you want to say, just a mass killing and immiseration. And frankly, look, I don't know what the value of these debates are, and if you are a journalist who, prides yourself on writing multiple foreign policy books, and you don't frame the question in that way, that in any way educates the American public to the reality of what is going on in Yemen, and you've asked that question of Joe Biden, it can be just about Khashoggi, which of course is a problem and horrible, but it's just part of the story. I don't know. I think that's a huge missed opportunity in terms of both the every aspect of why you would even do one of these things. So I don't know. It's been a long day.
Clearly, but that debate did not help anybody. It was a horrible job.
Look, I would be willing to bet that we're going to have half a day's worth of Amy Klobuchar really stood out. I mean, she really.
Well, they've been doing
really
that after every single
debate. Exactly.
So of course,
and now she's polling in people who are 73 and over, living in certain quarters of the country. She's like polling 14%. So, like, I think we're definitely seeing some movement. I mean, that's what we're going to hear. Here is. Bernie Sanders was largely ignored in the first hour of the debate. He had an opportunity in a minute 21, I believe it was, to talk about Medicare for All. I mean, look, he is by any measure, and even their own polling that they showed in between the things showed that he was more or less tied for second, I think, nationally. Maybe he was down a point, maybe he was up a point. I can't remember between him and Warren. He has the most aggressive Medicare for All program, and so they asked him about it in minute 21 of the debate. Here it is.
Senator, thank you, Senator. Senator Sanders, let me bring you into this conversation.
Thank you. I wrote the
ask
damn
you
bill.
The question.
Indeed.
Well, I want to ask you the question this way, Senator Sanders. You described your campaign, including your plans for Medicare for All, as a political revolution.
Yes.
President Obama explicitly said the country is, quote, less revolutionary than it is interested in improvement. The average American doesn't think we have to completely tear down the system and remake it, end quote. Is President
this
Obama wrong?
This is the
wrong?
Worst way they possibly could have asked this
we
question.
We don't have to tear down the system. But we do have to do what the American people want. And the American people understand today that the current healthcare system is not only cruel, it is dysfunctional. Now, you tell me how we have a system in which we spend twice as much as do the people of any other country, and yet we got 87 million uninsured, underinsured. In some cases, we pay 10 times more for prescription drugs as do the people of Canada or other countries. 500,000 people go bankrupt because of medically related issues. They come down with cancer, and that's a reason to go bankrupt. Now, some of the people up here think that we should not take on the insurance industry. We should not take on the pharmaceutical industry. But you know what? If you think back to FDR, and if you think back to JFK and Harry Truman and Barack Obama, as a matter of fact, people have been talking about health care for all. Well, you know what? I think now is the time. And in the first week of my administration, we will introduce Medicare for All. Medicare for All, that means no deductibles, no co-payments, no out-of-pocket expenses.
Senator,
that's where we got to go.
Now, I mean, the interesting thing about this is that Barack Obama has weighed in again in the 2020 election. And I think it's quite clear that he is attempting to stop, I think Bernie and I think, frankly, Warren as well. I mean, I think there's a very good argument that Deval Patrick is in the race largely to both inhibit Warren and Sanders from gaining a toehold, particularly in New Hampshire, maybe in other states. On Friday, Alex Breen's going to come in. He's written a piece about this to a certain extent. But I think there's a concerted effort to stop the both of them. And I don't know what the solution is for folks on that end. But the idea that Barack Obama is taking time off from his
Netflix career.
Helping people express
Netflix
themselves
career,
in the artistic form.
The guy from Virgin Airlines. I mean, whatever.
Oh,
whatever
you want to do a Richard Branson joke
whatever,
as
whatever.
Well?
Yeah. I don't know. Whatever,
parasailing
whatever he's
with
doing.
Branson.
I mean, look.
Yes.
I am of the mind that, like, look. I personally, I would rather a former president not live the life of a millionaire playboy who's married. That's just my personal taste. But
you
if
like
you're gonna
like one that isn't married.
No. I'm just saying that's that, funny. Like, you know. Jimmy Carter, not necessarily the greatest president, not necessarily the greatest politics, but there's a guy who has spent, who is using his cachet as an ex-president to set some specific type of tone. If
Obama had gotten us card check, he could have as many private islands as he wants for all I care.
I agree with that. That's the thing is that I don't really feel strongly about that. Like, I also think that, like, you put 8 years in like that, you took a lot of grief. Fine. You want to go and live that life. You know, God bless you.
But what are you talking? What are you complaining about? Just say thank you, please.
Can we play that for
but,
Sam every day?
I'm willing to say thank you, please. But to come back into it, to come back into the race and put your finger, you know, put your foot on the scales, your thumb on the scales, your toe on the scales, whatever. I don't know. Whatever it is he's putting on the scales.
Well, at least it shows he really believes in something, right? That's something being like failed neoliberal policies.
I got to say, I don't even know when I think it's a combination. And I read the Perrine piece. That's sort of interesting that like Bloomberg is the stalking horse for all of the Clintonites who have a pathological hatred of Sanders, and Deval's a stalking horse for the Obama people that don't like Warren. And what I think is interesting is that, I mean, sure, there is an ideological opposition to both, but in both cases, it's super personal. And I think that, you know, even in this case with Obama, sure, we already know Obama's to the right. But I think it's also that she annoyed a lot of people in the Obama universe. And it's actually the same just pettiness, basically, that you see in so many instances.
I don't doubt it. I don't think any of these people are principled enough to be actually acting upon. But I do think that, to a certain extent, these personal interactions are driven in a certain way by different worldviews. And I think particularly when you have people like Obama, frankly, in my experience, it is perceived as personal because it is people who are sort of bucking stuff that I think those people who are bucking stuff often tend to be, to have a different worldview. I think that Warren genuinely was a pain in the ass for the Obama administration because of her ideological perspective. I don't think that was, you know, to the left, but I think also Bernie, to a certain extent, was considered a pain in the ass to the Clinton people because ultimately at the end of the day, because of his ideology, probably caused him to not give a shit about certain things.
All right.
So I do think that it is petty, but I also think that pettiness sometimes is reflective of just, the reason why we don't get along is because you gross me out in some way. And the reason why you gross me out is because you don't seem to care that you're immiserating millions of people on their home ownership, or you don't seem to care that you have an opportunity to expand healthcare in a bigger way, but you're not being as ambitious because of certain personal ambitions. I mean, I think that may play into it, but. But
do you really think Obama's going to change anyone's mind about Bernie, though, at this point? Like his framing was so ineffective to me. He's like, you want to burn down this system and create a new one. First of all, Medicare is part of the system that already exists. we're just going to give it to everyone. Second of all, like, people hate this system. The system sucks.
Well, I think
talking about healthcare specifically.
Specifically, I think just the fact that they used Obama in the framing of that question answers your question. It may not change people's disposition about Bernie, but it certainly changes people's disposition, I think, about the viability of Medicare for All. And, you know, we see a bunch of different polling on Medicare for All, but the fact is, it's how you ask the question, and which I think gives you at least a perspective on what the challenge is for a politician who supports Medicare for All, because they're going to go in and have to argue with the American public, and they're going to be arguing against hundreds of millions of dollars that are going to be aligned against it. And so the fact that they cited, they didn't have to cite Barack Obama in that question, but the fact that they did, I think, shows the efficacy, at least, or at least the perception that if Barack Obama says something, and he's wildly popular with Democrats, I mean, I don't know what his numbers are, probably 80% or something.
I think that what he said, just to piggyback on what you're saying, though, is, I mean, Bernie just flat out, like, we're not talking about destroying the system.
Oh, Bernie's answer, I thought, was great, because he basically didn't even argue with Obama. He said, yes, I'm totally with Obama. And then he shifted what Obama said.
Exactly the play he should make.
Exactly.
And I think on top of that, the advantage that Medicare for All and Bernie have in dealing with Obama is, first, that's the right strategy. And secondly, there's other clips of Obama saying something different about Medicare for All, specifically, that it's a good idea. So,
right. And he said that months ago.
And I actually think this is something Bernie's actually really advantaged at, because I think that he is, and Eric Levitz, I think, got to some of this in a piece he wrote recently, that Bernie is very effective at, I think, speaking to a split in people, which is that, of course, there's a huge amount of disgust at, you know, banks and insurance companies and how the economic system works. And I think there is also a craving for moderation and reform and a sense of continuity. And I think when Bernie kind of hits the latter point sort of thematically and the former point substantively, he does well. And that's why, yeah, he dealt with Obama perfectly. Like, yeah, I agree with Barack. Like, America's awesome, and we don't want to get rid of apple pie and baseball. I just want everybody to have health care.
I mean, that's right. They called it Medicare for All, right? Because people already know what Medicare is and they like it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think that works pretty well. And I also think what I like about Obama is that Obama is so opportunistic himself, because I have no doubt. I mean, there's people that I really do question whether or not, like, a Hillary Clinton will endorse Bernie Sanders, to be honest. But I have no doubt that Barack Obama will endorse and campaign with anyone who's the nominee. And if it's Bernie, he'll know exactly how to track back to, like, this is what I've been talking about.
Exactly. Yes, that's true. Without a doubt. I just find it annoying that he is, like, my feeling is, dude, go spend, you know, wait until the convention, show up at the convention, give a good speech. You're awesome at it. In the meantime, go to St. Bart's, or I don't know, wherever.
Go to Martinique. But
whatever.
Can I just say too,
whatever the place you would go to.
One of those kind of water jet ski
believer.
Things.
And, well, no, and specifically.
He would die for tax credits.
What's annoying about him doing this, though, is the total calibration about how he responded to Trump. And yes, they did occasionally with healthcare and the Muslim ban. He would put out, like, a Facebook statement, which isn't typical. But over 90%, he observed normal post-presidential protocol on Trump.
Well, he was waiting for something really important.
He waited till the midterms to campaign against Trump, which is typical. And, you know, he could just as easily, if he was following that MO, just keep his mouth shut in the primary. So that is a little revealing, I think.
All right. What other clips do we have? Do we have anything else? Let's play this clip here.
Cory Booker talking about weed with Biden.
Oh, yeah. Booker talking about weed. What's this one here?
Where he brings up,
all right. Let's play it.
Okay.
I may have been the first person up here to make it clear that Saudi Arabia not only murdered Khashoggi, but this is a brutal dictatorship which does everything it can to crush democracy, treats women as third-class citizens. And when we rethink our American foreign policy, what
we have got to know is that Saudi Arabia is not a reliable ally. We have got to bring Iran and Saudi Arabia together in a room under American leadership and say we are sick and tired of us spending huge amounts of money and human resources because of your conflicts. And by the way, the same thing goes with Israel and the Palestinians. It is no longer good enough for us simply to be pro-Israel. I am pro-Israel. But we must treat the Palestinian people as well with the respect and dignity that they deserve. What is going on in Gaza right now, where youth unemployment is 70 or 80%, is unsustainable. So we need to be rethinking who our allies are around the world, work with the United Nations, and not continue to support brutal dictatorships.
Good stuff.
Strong.
I think Warren, it was interesting when she, do we have that clip of her Medicare for All response? I mean, she, it was interesting. She, I'm not quite sure I understand just from a strategic standpoint what she's doing. To be honest with you, I mean, I think that like her first tranche of Medicare for All would be great. I don't. There's no one I think I've talked to who thinks that having two pieces of legislation to do this is in any way a smart tactic or a strategy. She almost made a point of having a second vote in her answer, which I thought was like it's almost like she feels compelled not to ignore the fact she, I think they know. I mean, I've talked to advocates of Medicare for All who were very disappointed with not so much. I mean, had her plan been you vote once and the first transition is what she outlines here, and then the second transition kicks in automatically, it would have been, you know, a slight variation from what Sanders' plan is. But the bottom line is that nobody that I've spoken to thinks that having two votes is a plan. It's, I mean, I guess it's a plan, but it's a bad plan. And it's interesting to hear her response here because it's almost as if she sort of knows it, but can't help but mention that you have to do it. It's, there's something sort of both like oddly sad and impressive that she can't, that she has the integrity of hanging on to this plan that you can't help but think is
designed
not the right
to
plan.
Fail.
I don't know that it's designed to fail. I think it's designed to be distinct. And that is a problem, I think. It is just a, it, what it indicates to me is less a question of sincerity and more a function of
too clever by half.
It cuts against her core brand proposition, to use a Michael Brooks phrase,
indeed,
in that it is actually not smart strategically. And that is, to the extent that she has a core brand proposition, it is that she knows how to maneuver, you know, within this world.
Right.
And this is you know, and part of the reason why I think, frankly, that Bernie Sanders came into the race was her mess up when it came to the whole DNA test thing, which I think was indicative of maybe that she wasn't as good of a politician as some people had hoped. And I think that like her being boxed in to come up with a financing plan that was that specific was also problematic. And this is another indicative of it. I mean, watch it. Like the plan itself that she talks about in the first tranche, I think is a good plan. That would be great if you voted on this and the first thing that happened in the first 100 days is what she's talking about. And by the end of the 4 years, you get the rest of the people on board. That would be great. But the idea that second vote's going to happen is just, I think, fantastical.
on day one as president, I will do bring down the cost of prescription drugs on things like insulin and EpiPens. That's going to save tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars for people. I'm going to defend the Affordable Care Act from the sabotage of the Trump administration. And in the first 100 days, I'm going to bring in 135 million people into Medicare for All at no cost to them. Everybody under the age of 18, everybody who has a family of four, income less than $50,000. I'm going to lower the age of Medicare to 50 and expand Medicare coverage to include vision and dental and long-term care. And then in the third year, when people have had a chance to feel it and taste it and live with it, we're going to vote and we're going to want Medicare for All.
Senator, thank you, Senator.
Yeah, after the midterms, which will probably reduce the number of Democrats.
I don't want to make a sincerity argument, but I mean, that is, and I mean, he is insincere, but that is Buttigieg's, he's still making that kind of general argument, which is you're going to have a public option and then it's going to be so desirable that it will sort of naturally roll over. He still says that.
Well, yeah, so no, I think, you know, that dynamic is similar. Yeah, but yes. what the initial offering is.
Oh, hers is way more generous.
Way more generous.
And for what it's worth, tactically, even though I am 100% Medicare for All, but I'll just say tactically, if she had come out of the gate, especially because she's been, and you know, at least rhetoric. Well, no, she, in my view, she's been all over the place on this. If she came out of the gate and just said, I have the radically generous public option plan and I am not as, you know, full scale as Bernie, I think that would have worked better.
I wouldn't characterize what she's talking about as a public option. She's talking about a massive expansion of Medicaid, which would double or triple. I mean, she's talking about getting almost every single person who is not covered by insurance covered, and then providing better benefits for another 100 million people. And that is a good plan. But I think the problem is, and this is completely a political analysis, I think from a policy perspective, I think you're right. I mean, if she had come out with that, I think there would be a decent argument as to, like, I mean, frankly, I think that if you get another 135 million people on a Medicare for All program, including the 45 million that are already there, you're talking about over, you know, 55-60% of the American public who are going to be on a Medicare for All. Now, you still have private health insurance in there, but I think the idea of, like, of the second vote is silly. It's just not going to happen. I mean, even if the American public is completely on board after 2 years, when I think it takes longer than that for people to sort of appreciate it, it's just not going to happen. And it's just a very cumbersome thing. And it really, for me, it's less about her sincerity towards getting there, and it's more about just sort of I'm worried about the politics, and I'm worried about what it says in terms of her as a politician. I think part of her surge was a function of people sort of getting over what they thought was an early stumble in her campaign and a recovery. And then when the pressure got turned up, there was, and I don't know that I, you know, look, when I say her, I'm talking about her campaign and I'm talking about the people that she's surrounded with. And I think there's probably a good argument that, that they can't quite figure it out. And that, I think, is problematic. It scares me in the general election. As a policy prescription, I think it's pretty good. I think it's going to be very hard to get. I think ultimately, if I had to guess, regardless of who's president, in the best case scenario, we're going to get something that's going to look like that, maybe a little bit less in the first round.
That's the Obama argument.
I'm worried,
right,
about the politics.
Well, you don't start there.
That's what I'm saying.
You don't start there.
Your negotiations in the middle.
Sure.
We're suiting up for war here. It's going to be a huge, huge challenge to take on the private insurance industry. And you cannot start from anything less than the whole thing. And, I have serious doubts as to whether leaving the private insurance industry intact is going to be a good idea in the long term. I mean, Tim Pfaus compared it to like moving to a new house because you've got termites and then bringing the termites with you to your new house. I'm also worried about the politics of passing even the first part of her plan, because as we know, the insurance industry treats any attempts to get it under control, even the ACA, which was the most market-friendly, watered-down thing ever, as like a full-scale socialist expropriation attack. You know, so given that fact, we need to choose somebody who not only has a good plan, but who has a good understanding of politics and power and the kind of massive outside grassroots pressure that you're going to need to get it passed.
I mean, it could be a scenario where you have a Sanders presidency and we push like hell for it. And then, you know, the compromise is what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I would start with the full enchilada because, you know, chances are you're not going to get the full enchilada. But I think that, like, you know, I don't know if there's any real question that, like, if Elizabeth Warren is president, the Bernie Sanders would say, like, oh, I'm just going to sit this one out because I'm not president. I'm not going to push for it. I mean, I think, you know, to the extent that there's, you know, that's okay. Why I say, like, you know, we'll know at least after Iowa and New Hampshire if the theory that Sanders is operating under is actually in effect, which is that they've been able to mobilize people who don't show up in the way that we poll. But I think, you know, analyzing on its own terms, like, I'm not sure what the value of splitting the difference is that way. And I think you're right, Michael. Had she started out as this is not a sort of like a, you know, like a semi retreat, but rather this is as far as I'm going to go and I'm going to go this way. I mean, on some level, it's sort of like analogous, and I don't have the issues that other people have with this, where they're saying I'm a capitalist to my bones because, you know, in the same way that I forgive Bernie Sanders for not saying, well, F Barack Obama, he's full of shit. I mean, that would be a dumb thing to say politically. I think that if I was to inject Bernie Sanders with truth serum and put him in a room and say, no one's going to hear your answer, what's your response?
All right. He's an idiot.
Right. Of course. Like, yeah, this is the problem I had with this guy. But he knows
opportunity.
He knows that this is not about him, you know, presenting himself as someone who's going to say the exact true thing that's in his heart. The idea is at the end of the day, he wants to get as much material benefit for as many people as possible. And if that means that he doesn't get up there and say, you know, Barack Obama is the world's greatest devil and he's full of shit, then he will be able to do it. I thought that was one of the most impressive things about that answer, frankly, was that he showed, like, yeah, you're right, Barack Obama. And he basically jujitsued Obama into arguing for what he was arguing for. And I think to a certain extent, right. I think there's a little bit of that with Warren, but she's not showing that political acumen insofar as that, like, you know, if you painted yourself into a corner about the funding for Medicare for All, you continue to say, like, it's about cost. I don't care. I mean, I think you need to be able to do that.
And those are like the two poles that are frustrating about her on a political, like, she could have either, we talked about it, come out with this plan from day one and said it is what it is. I think it's also analogous to student debt. I support Bernie's approach. But you have that argument, like, get rid of all of it, or you have a very progressive approach to it. Or she could have just said, I'm a co-signer of Bernie's bill. I support it 100%. And as with everything else, I'm the one you should trust to implement it strategically.
Exactly. I'm going to be able to execute
it.
Well,
but the biggest fear that I have at this point is that we look at the numbers and it, you know, it depends on what poll you look at. But if you start adding up Buttigieg and Biden, they start getting into higher numbers than you get when you get Warren and Sanders. And if you start looking at, like, where is all the efforts coming to suppress candidates. There's no, you know, Dennis Kucinich is not coming out of retirement to take out Pete Buttigieg. But we are seeing Deval Patrick and we're seeing Mike Bloomberg. And maybe they genuinely are coming in because they think I've got 100% chance to win. Or maybe they're coming in going, like, I have 100% chance to influence the outcome of this race. It may involve me. It may not involve me. So I think that, you know, as people who want progressive outcomes, we need to
walk and chew gum at the same time. But speaking bubble of gum. Which, I also need to go to sleep.
Yes, go to sleep.
So
call Sam 662.
So it's been a long day. We will be back live tomorrow, which will be Friday, because this will be recorded and tacked on to the end of the podcast. And then we also put the do you want me to put the post roll on right now?
Sure.
Since I've remembered to do it.
Oh, that's a
recording too.
What's that?
We have a recording.
I know you have a recording, but let's now I can do it right now.
Fantastic.
Ladies and gentlemen, Capterra. It's the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 1 million reviews of products from real software users, discover everything you need to make an informed decision. I'm gonna go home right now, and I'm going to go to Capterra.com/majority. I'm going to do it for free, and I'm going to find tools to make an informed software decision about my business, A, B, and then I'm going to find another business. I'm going to do both. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's C-A-P-T-E-R-R-A. CAPTERRA.com/majority. Capterra, software selection simplified. You can support this program by becoming a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the show commercial free, and you get extra content on every single day except for today. Now, if you feel like you've been cheated and you haven't gotten extra content, go back to yesterday and the day before, and you can get like 12 hours of extra content. Check it out. And also, please sign up for the AM Quickie. Do me a favor. Will you please? Please? AMQuickie.com. And check it out. You'll enjoy it. People say they don't believe it's me. I do it half the time.
It's AM, Sam.
I have a lot of people, like good friends, who say to me, like, that's not really you, is it?
It's 10-10 wins, Sam.
And I'm like, what are you talking about? And I guess when I read, I don't have the same stutter. I don't have the same, like, you know, pregnant pauses. And I sound much more directed. And people think it's a different person.
Joe Biden is an asshole, Kathy. That's right. I'm Sam Cedar.
Honestly,
that's
what I do have a little bit of that.
that also you sound different when you go on TV.
I do sound different?
I find, yeah.
It's weird. I don't hear it, but I mean, I believe you. But today is Thursday. It's Thursday. And
so
the
is.
Other day was some other day, Michael.
Oh, my God. We're really doing this? Okay. I talked with the former Ecuadorian foreign minister, Guillermo Long, about the coup in Bolivia and a whole bunch of other stuff. Patreon.com/TMBS.
Oh, my God.
Jamie.
Oh, my God. What do we even have right now? This week on the Antifada. So I'm not on this episode, but you should listen to it anyway. That's a terrible pitch. Sean and Andy are in Europe doing a survey of various trains.
Excuse me.
And they, what?
I said, excuse me. We go to Europe to do a show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So they were.
Impeachment coverage from Europe.
they were in London for the Historical Materialism Conference, blah, blah, blah. So they went to have some cans with the lads and lass of England's only podcast, Trash Future. Very funny podcast if you guys have never listened to it. They talk about the upcoming elections, the deep insecurities at the center of posh life motivating Boris Johnson's political career, the Lib Dem and Chuck Cucks, and Corbyn's cheeky plan to nationalize Nando's and put Mr. Bean on the dole or whatever.
Next week, I am doing impeachment coverage from Nevis. I will be... Matt, what's happening with
what's happening is people are going and subscribing to Literary Hangover. Thanks, folks.
All right. See you guys Friday. We're going to start early, 11 a.m.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright.